just not paced herself, that she'd just overdone it too early without caring about the consequences. Another Abe Lincoln chin drop that would force me to take control of this party that I wanted no part in. My own parties that year were too many and too wearing, on a level more than just some simple headache and a need to hydrate. I'm talking worn to the point where you can feel your pulse in internal organs that aren't your heart. Even when I managed to join the mob that was now circling her, head down on the concrete, unresponsive and in a pool of blood, I still did not take it seriously. Like torn skin on dogs, head wounds on people bleed quite a bit. As her family all but removed their helmets and took a knee in prayer like football players do surrounding an injured player on the field, I leaned in and made snide jokes. I even took some pictures to mock her with later when she woke up in the hospital. One of her friends was a nurse and worked on her vigorously as we waited for the 911 call to arrive. There's a part of me that comes to the surface sometimes at moments like this, where I am drunk and I think I'm smarter than the professional. And that's reinforced by the very few times that I've been right. Tonight, on some level, I dismissed this nurse at the party as being overly dramatic because he got to use his skills right there in an audience of his peers. I scoffed internally, thinking that I knew bingo better than he knew medicine and that she'd be back in a few hours where we could all goof on her new stitches. Even when the ambulance took her in a neck brace and loaded her into the back, I took a picture to show her what a silly ruckus she caused. And as they drove her away, I went back to the funhouse, shook my head, and poured another cocktail. Now I'm fucking hosting again. I'd half expected the rest of the crowd to join me and await word. Only the few from my own crew hung back. Somehow it didn't occur to me that all of her closest friends and family might race behind the ambulance to the hospital. And when word came back that she was in very bad condition and would be life-flighted to Tucson, I still assumed that most of them would come back to the house. At that hour, I assume everyone in the world has had too much to drink to drive, not just me. So the few of us waited as most of her party led a caravan on the 2-hour drive to the hospital in Tucson. We stared at our phones and our glasses. We made phone calls to get everyone up to date, although we had no update to tell them. These are the moments where we swing hardest at the pinata of gallows humor, and we had the perfect squad, and then suddenly the perfect accoutrement. Joby arrived. Turns out that in the emergency room of the hospital in Bisbee, one of Bingo's sisters had been rifling through her fanny pack, looking for her ID and her insurance cards. What she found along with them was a ball of cocaine the size of an obese duck's egg. The sister wasn't narcotic savvy, but she'd seen a movie or two and knew that this should not be found on Bingo's person. She palmed it and gave it to Joby, and Joby brought it to us. Generally, I'm against cocaine at parties. Like bird cloud, it can change the dynamic. Unless there's enough for everyone, those holding tend to break off into toilets or closets and create parties of their own away from everyone. But we did, in fact, have more than enough for the few that remained. And I'm also against waste. Plus, this would make it far easier to stay awake for word of news, and funnier. We talked about all the work Bingo had put into the party and for how long, the events she'd planned, the ridiculous outfits she'd picked out not just for herself but to force everyone else to wear. She couldn't make the Swedish meatballs, but goddamn right she had a dinosaur onesie that she was gonna make you wear. We were talking about all the plans and the people who had traveled so far to make it here, and how sad it was that it all fell apart early on the very first night. And after a short silence, Joby said, "Yeah, just when you thought Bingo couldn't make this more all about herself." The room fell to the floor. Like I said, Joby spent a life around death. Then he chopped out several long rails of blow down the bar for the gang. They gave me the straw and told me that I got to go first, since although I hadn't bought it, I had certainly paid for it. And like Woody Allen in the famous scene from Annie Hall, I accidentally coughed my deepest smoker hack just as I leaned in and blew all of the lines across the bar. It wasn't as though there wasn't plenty more. I honestly can't tell you if that was before or after we got the call from Tucson. I can't tell you who we got the call from, but the news was far worse than anyone imagined. Our old friend Dr. Mark worked trauma at the University Medical Center in Tucson, and he was on duty and on the roof with Bingo when the helicopter landed. She was in a coma with a fractured skull and bleeding on the brain. The chances were good that she wasn't going to make it. I may have cried when I wrote that sentence, but at the time I didn't believe it. I don't believe it was any kind of denial. It felt more like a conspiracy theorist disbelieving any sensationalized story he hears in the news. This was something to debunk. Again, it felt like I knew more than the professionals. Maybe it was the cocktails and the blow, but I was arrogant in disregarding it. What I wouldn't learn until later were the specific details of Bingo's tumble, that she hadn't been drunk, that she'd in fact had another seizure in the midst of a conversation with some friends and fell backwards from the third step, hard, directly on the back of her head on the concrete platform at the bottom. Still, I believed the show must go on. Even Erin, our bartender hired for the next day, called to reconfirm. I told her what was happening and she asked if she should still come to be there for us. I told her absolutely she needed to be there, because if Bingo did in fact die, we'd need a bartender more than ever. Erin showed up with a friend and the party continued. I use the word party only because some people were still showing up that had no idea what had happened, locals mostly. And those of us who had been running through the night and trying to keep each other from falling apart were now so out of our tit that newcomers thought that they were late for the show. Our friend Andrew wouldn't believe the story, because not only why wouldn't I be there at her bedside, but why the fuck would everybody be having this much fun? I'll tell you why. Out of spite and the ability to piss in the face of the cruelty of life. I wasn't at her bedside because I knew that everyone who'd flown out was already there, crying or saying prayers and holding hands and all of those things that other people do in these situations. I'd barely be able to push through the scrum to see her vacant face with tubes coming out of it, only to have my inappropriate retorts make it all the worse. That was my thinking. They didn't need me at the hospital. They needed me here. There was also plenty to be handled at the house. Amongst all the other gizmos and attractions she'd borrowed, requested, or rented for this shindig, she had a bouncy castle on its way, as well as one of those old arcade photo booths that gives you a strip of four pictures. Not only did we have to cancel them, we had to find out who they were coming from, and the only person to ask was in a coma. And sometime in that blizzard of emotion and insobriety with night turning into day, I had some hard decisions to make. I had a string of upcoming shows scheduled, the first being the most important. The next day was election night, and I was supposed to be in LA for the End of the World podcast. It was going to be an epic cast of big-name comedians all rotating on stage in the Comedy Store's main room, broadcasting our own live coverage of the election with Joe Rogan, Bill Burr, and myself as anchors. Joe and I had done a stand-up show together called The End of the World Show on the eve of the much-hyped 12-21-12 Mayan calendar apocalypse theory, and the turnout filled the theater to the walls. Election night 2016 seemed like the perfect time to do a sequel. Although the whole thing had been my idea and in the works for months, I'd tried to beg out of it even before Bingo's accident. First of all, it seemed obvious to everyone that it would be a no-contest landslide for Clinton and thus make the show a snoozer. I wasn't in LA and had not the slightest clue on logistics or the mechanics of how to even get the proper gear. Also, I didn't want to have to reach out to other comics to ask them to be part of it. If you're not in the business, you may not know that asking another comedian to be on your podcast is greeted as warmly as would any Jehovah's Witness at your door early on a Sunday morning. A Jehovah's Witness that is deaf with a stutter. And the thought of having to reach out to comedians of that stature who I knew little or some not at all made my stomach an acid bath. I'd poured all of these reasons to abandon the project into Rogan's ear, and he overcame each objection like a professional telemarketer. I caved back in. So now to drop back out again on a day's notice somehow felt like I was using Bingo's vegetative state and possibly terminal condition as some kind of feeble, my dog ate my homework excuse. This was the state of my mind at the time, that somehow being at my wife's bedside when she might die would cast me in some negative light professionally and let people down. Bottle raised, I shouted at those in the funhouse, "Fuck it! We don't cancel gigs!" And I would say it again and again as I drank myself numb enough to actually agree with it. My dog Ichabod would occasionally wander past that puddle of blood that Bingo had left behind on the concrete slab and casually lap at it. I demanded that nobody clean it up. Chapter 18, The End of the World. Chad, Chaley, and I bypassed the hospital and went directly to LA for the show. Spun out and turned out and in any shape other than to entertain. There had been no change in Bingo's condition, and if the worst happened, her timing, I must say, was impeccable. She would have planned her last hurrah for over a year so that people had time and were together to be there and make it convenient to watch her die. No need to ask the airline for last-minute bereavement fare. She gave him plenty of time to prepare for it as a vacation. Focus on the positive. The particulars of our relationship, non-sexual, asexual, however distant or addicted, however lacking in boundaries or communication, as separated as our artistic proclivities were, her music and mine comedic, yet still inspiring one another. Even the brief separations never threatened the notion that we would be together for the rest of our lives. Now that day might have arrived sooner than I could have ever imagined, and I'm in Los Angeles, spiraled as low as I could go, thinking that we don't cancel gigs was some kind of cause to champion. Johnny Depp wasn't in LA, but again left his house open and stocked for us to stay. It was just down the street from the Comedy Store, and we got there only hours before showtime. Chaley and Chad turned in for naps, and I sat muddle-eyed in the kitchen contemplating the worst. I was beyond hopeless. I had transcended drunk. I was shell-shocked and 6 degrees of separation from myself. I sat there over a smoldering ashtray, staring at a painting that covered half the wall across from me, a painting that I'd stared at through a dozen drunk nights here before. It was some creepy-looking French playwright named Artaud, who I'd never heard of, but it always reminded me of Marilyn Manson. But now, lost from everything that resembled reality, it struck me that Manson might be the only person who could possibly be able to understand my state of mind. Madness is Marilyn's comfort zone. It was probably around 5 o'clock that afternoon when I called his phone, a phone I was sure he'd never answer. I'd only ever talked to him on the phone closer to 5 in the morning, when he'd call me with nonsensical yet hilarious ramblings that could last hours. There's no way he'd be fielding calls during the dinner hour, but he did. I gave him the short version of what was happening, and he told me that he'd be there in 30 minutes with cocaine and Krispy Kreme donuts. and despite the unlikelihood of him even picking up the phone, the rush hour LA traffic, and how off-the-charts psychotic I must have sounded, Manson arrived on time and with a manservant carrying a box of donuts, powder on the side. This may sound like rock and roll, but Manson is one of the most docile and caring creatures I've ever met. At this point, the cocaine was again strictly medicinal for focus, and a donut was probably the only food I could force myself to swallow. It was apparent that I was beyond needing someone to talk to. I just needed someone who got it. And nobody's got fucked down like Manson. Chad and Chaley joined us. There was some blind yammering and recounting of events that we were all tired of telling, while a large straw made its rounds over perfectly crafted lines of cocaine. The straw was inordinately long, black hard plastic with a swirling white stripe running up it like a candy cane, like it had been crafted for a stage presentation of Tim Burton's Nightmare Before Christmas. The absurdity of all of this was somehow grounding. To add to this, a gigantic wooden statue of a shrieking ape, a prop from the set of Fear and Loathing, loomed over us on the deck as the sun was setting. Its arms were spread in an attack stance, and scrawled in paint across its chest, bicep to bicep, read, "You can run, but you can't hide." We resigned ourselves to the fact that it was showtime.
Douglas! Douglas, me boy! Doug Stanhope! I almost married him in the early 2000s.
Rogan,
it's it. It's over.
Rogan, this is all I have. All I have is a fake smile and an opener.
Because you wrote something?
No, this is a text I sent to you last week.
Okay.
When I was at, I thought, the worst day of my life.
Yeah.
Until today. And I came to town to try to organize this, and I don't know what the fuck. I can't live stream. What is it?
I
can talk. So this is what I sent to Rogan at the depths of what I thought was the worst hangover ever. I'm in a serious panic mode and really want to bail on it, meaning this. I think it's a great idea, but I have no idea how to organize it, and it's so close. The Comedy Store gave us the day, and I don't want to fuck them over, but I don't know how to make this work. I fucked up and don't know how to put it together. I don't want to put all this on you, but I don't want to be the guy responsible for an abortion. But so far, only you and a vague Bill Burr have committed. I want to fake a stroke to get out of ruining it. Save me. P.S. It's been a long week. Rogan very succinctly writes back, "I'll handle it. Don't sweat it. It's nothing. We show up. We drink. I smoke pot. We talk. Easy." And I was immediately, everything's fine. Fucking Rogan says it's good. It's good.
I like that Doug says in the email, "I don't want to be the guy responsible for an abortion, but he's totally had abortions that he's paid for."
Bert Kreischer bringing it down. Plus, when Donald Trump becomes president, you're a fucking criminal.
Abortion.
He's coming for you.
He draws it at 8.
I don't want to be the guy responsible for a plethora of abortions.
By the way, if you thought this was going to be about the election, no. It's the end of the world either way.
Yeah, and if you guys you wouldn't be here.
I have to do this. Brett Erickson! Erickson! We do have our breaking news guy. Brett Erickson, fantastic comic, is actually having to watch the CNN coverage. So if anything actually does matter, he'll run out and be breaking
news.
He
has a laptop.
Yep.
He's got a laptop
Erickson.
Back there and he's watching it.
He's all fucking around.
That's right.
That's all he's got is a laptop.
We could just do four hours.
And we realized that before the show.
It's
like, do you have any TV screens? Are there any laptops? What are we going to do out there? It's very hastily thrown together, yet planned for months. You texted me about this easily in August. Easily.
In you August. Talked about it with me a year ago. A year ago, he came up with it.
I realized
I thought
Doug just
everyone would say
things.
No. I think everyone doesn't like me. When he returned my text, I was scared.
That girl just went, aww. That's adorable.
Yeah, so, there's an election. It doesn't matter if you care about who
does. It kind of does. What matters the most is that no matter who wins, we're all of us really like, okay. I mean, it's not good.
I'm going to tell a story. We're fucking, you know.
I knew when you said I can't tell the story, you were going to tell it. Just tell it.
I have to tell a story. Shit's bad at home, but when the EMTs are taking her, my girlfriend, out.
You got to tell the story because most people don't know what you're talking about.
My girlfriend had a seizure, fell back, fractured her skull. She's still not responsive. See, if I
my ex-girlfriend
story,
used to have
fucking cry,
my bag. Ex-girlfriend used to have seizures like that all the time.
Well, I know that
she
it's
kept burning
related.
Fucking dinner.
Oh, man. You went for it. I'm like, I don't know where you're going with this.
If you guys don't hang around with comedians, your life sucks. That's why you paid money to be here. That's the only way I get through life is because I have the best fucking comic friends that can bust my balls. So, bingo. I know it's cocaine related. It's her 40th birthday. The whole family is there in Bisbee. She has a seizure, fractures her skull. They're taking her out. The EMTs, they're holding her head. I'm just fucking busting balls, cracking joke. Oh, the pool of blood is getting bigger. I go, don't clean that up. I need a good picture in daylight. And then my dogs start licking up the blood. So they didn't clean it up, but they covered it because I needed to get a picture. Because, this is not the first time it's happened. So I don't really think it's going to end up like it is now. Fuck her. She knows better than to do that much blow. So I'm cracking wise. I don't even know if I remember my story. What was I going to not tell? Oh, the fanny pack. So here's what happens. The sisters, Bingo's sister, Bongo and Bango, I call them. They're like, I don't know what to do. I go, someone go down. Everyone's calling 911. Go down and make sure there's no coke residue or wherever. I know she's doing coke. And then I see her fanny pack, which she's very attached to. She's trying to bring the fanny pack back. It's not working. But I go, hey, take her fanny pack, because when she wakes up, she's going to freak out. Where's my fanny pack? It's a mental thing. And she wouldn't have blow in there. I go, she's not that dumb. Oh, yes, she will. Yeah. So the sisters, clean cut, all American sisters, go to the ER. I'm like, fuck it. I'm the host of the party now. You go to the ER. They find the blow, and it's a shitload of blow. So the sister smuggles it. It's 8 blocks away, but smuggles it like locked up abroad. Like, I found the blow. I was trying to find her insurance paperwork. I brought this back. And I, holy shit. And then we started doing her blow to stay awake. To find out the condition she's in. Like, she knows better than to do this. She has a problem with this. Anyone called yet? Did I make this weird? Is that the name of someone's podcast?
Awesome. This is awesome.
I'm just saying, Bingo's been listening for 34 minutes in a coma. There's a phone against her head. But if Bill Burr is right that Trump is president, I'm just going to say, Bingo, go towards the light.
Oh,
I'd love to recount to you the night that followed. I remember being little more than a seat filler on the stage as the early results started rolling in. Bill Burr and Joe Rogan were carrying the show as Bill gave the play-by-play of the incoming news, and by all accounts, they were crushing it. Morgan Murphy showed up. Jim Jeffries came and was quickly and thankfully told to leave because he'd brought his toddler son into the bar. Kreischer showed up and, as always, was quickly shirtless and the life of the party. As comedians began rotating in and out, I made more frequent trips to the green room bar, to my phone for any updates of Bingo's condition, and to the bathroom to completely fall apart. I couldn't bring myself to ever watch video of that night, not even for this book. I don't want to remember what it was like to be in that state, on a public stage no less, being broadcast across the world. I didn't even notice, believe, or care when the tide was decidedly and astoundingly going in favor of Trump. The comics were breaking into contentious debate on stage. It seemed like great theater to me, but it also felt like it was hijacking my real drama. I remember swinging from sobbing on the floor of the green room into bursts of trying to be bigger than my emotions, back into that false swagger of we don't cancel gigs mode, like a drunken hillbilly smashing beer bottles over his head to show you how much pain he could tolerate when he couldn't really feel a thing. As the audience were leaving the room in stunned disbelief that the election had been called for Trump, I remember berating them for not seeing the bigger picture, my bigger picture, as though they had just watched the Super Bowl where their team had lost, and in that course they were missing what really mattered in life. And in some way, I might have been right, or at least trying to say something that put some perspective on what had just transpired. But I'm sure that I was just yelling at myself for the exact same reason. I had left all perspective in the rear view and tried to throw lie in its eyes to blind it. But even in this total blur, I was still too smart to fool myself. It was time to cancel gigs. When I had that one wife, Renee, we were trying to enjoy a sober morning on vacation in Costa Rica. It was generally the only sober time we spent together, even on those days where we woke up still drunk. We were boogie boarding on the shores of Tamarindo in the Guanacast, complaining about how overcrowded it had become since we first started coming there a couple years before. We were those white people who began to add seniority to their privilege. At some point, the surf started to drag us out. I noticed with a bit of terror that I drifted past all the surfers who were always out in front of me like a buoy, always fucking up their perfect wave. I saw that the only other person out this far was Renee, who gave me eye contact that confirmed that we might be in trouble. I tried to paddle back in as hard as I could, with arms that go limp from a simple game of darts. When my wind ran out within short seconds, I panicked again with even less logic and left the boogie board to try to swim on my own. Genius survival technique to leave your only flotation device in a riptide when you have the lungs of a coal miner. My feet could occasionally hit the sand between waves before another rolled over my head and seemed to pull me back out. I had no breath or strength anymore, and I was sure that I was going to die. Then a lifeguard whistled at me to come back to shore, as though he didn't know that was everything I was doing in my power to stay alive. I'd like to say that I responded by giving him the finger, but I know I only pleaded for help with my eyes. The lifeguard came out and pulled me in. I lay trembling on the beach for many minutes trying to catch my breath like a beached whale trying to survive on dry land. And once I'd gotten over what I thought was my near-death experience and my embarrassment for having to be hauled in from what had to seem like shallow water to anyone watching, only then did I realize that I'd never once looked back for Renee. I had been all self-preservation. Whatever the reality, my own was that I was going to die, and I never once considered that I'd known she was in the same predicament. This wasn't a matter of being down on yourself or having low self-esteem. This was a matter of being tested and having failed. Turned out she was fine. She just rode her board wherever it took her until she could make her way back. It floated, for fuck's sake. And I jumped off mine. Not only was I an idiot, my instinct went immediately into every idiot for themselves mode. Even if she'd been in danger, there was nothing I could have done to help Renee. The same applied to Bingo. Logically, me being by her bedside would have no effect on her condition. But sometimes, logic can become in direct conflict with what you know to be right. Initially, in Bingo's case, I had some idea that being on the road and on stage, my ingrained safe space, would somehow be the best place I could be. It made as much sense as jumping off the boogie board without looking back for my wife. Chapter 19. I See You. The sight of Bingo when I walked into the ICU flattened me. She was propped somewhat upright from the shoulders, arms out, palms up from her sides, full of tubes and wires like a science project. On more than one occasion, she'd narrowly avoided having to have part of her skull removed to accommodate for the swelling. The tribe of family and friends that surrounded her and drifted into the waiting room had been there for enough days that the shock had worn off, and only the reality of uncertainty creased their faces. I tried to make some now-forgotten joke, one that no doubt I'd been working on since the plane. Open strong. But my mask of irreverence was betrayed as soon as I tried to speak, and my stiff upper lip broke into gulps of tears. This is a time where I will tend to overcompensate. Failing to control my emotions, I will correct myself and double down with something even more inappropriate still, as though I were bluffing with the crying the whole time. I got this shit. Lindy, the sister of our beloved whiskey girl and whose humor is inexhaustible, pulled me aside and told me calmly but semi-seriously that I wasn't allowed to cry. She explained that I was akin to a flight attendant on a plane during heavy turbulence. If the passengers were to see the flight attendant noticeably panicked, then it would be undeniable that they were all in serious trouble. I was the flight attendant. It was my job to say those things that break the silence, that address the morose and bring inconceivable levity to an incomprehensible situation. If I could keep my shit together, if I could keep the guise of someone unconcerned, lighthearted even, then maybe everyone could continue to cling to threads of hope. Not that I was the only one bringing playfulness to the table. People had by now organized into shifts to be at Bingo's side. The initial night shift consisted of Bingo's sisters and friends. I'd love to be more specific as to who, but I'd certainly leave someone out. The young ones who could hack those hours. Graveyard shift indeed. The fact is that they were there and making fun when there was visibly none to be had. They cropped her diaper into a more revealing cut and wrote Veronica's Secret on it. Bingo's hair was ratty and matted, especially where the staples had been put into her skull at the point of impact. Everyone was terrified at the thought of Bingo coming to, only to find that they'd had to shave her hair off. Her turquoise mane was her prized possession. So they took turns combing out clumps of hair only to save it up and then take pictures of Bingo with it spilling out of the top of her gown like blue chest hair. That's what happens when you pass out first at the party. The funny kept hope alive. I completely understand people who feel a need to air their personal despondency on social media, especially when the only person you're trying to reach is right in front of you, yet no closer than the occasional flutter of an eyelash. I went on Twitter and implored people to save their thoughts and prayers and to instead tweet inappropriate jokes. They didn't hesitate, and I shot back and doubled down where I could. Some low-level gossip websites picked up on it and wrote their customary shit-stirring dreck of disapproval. Never their own, of course, only saying that I'm being criticized or that some people are outraged without one single example of someone who had expressed any offense. One of the things that has bothered me most about Trump is his coining the phrase fake news as a response to facts, when indeed there is so much fake news that should fall into that category otherwise. But this also served to make me aware that part of me enjoyed this situation. This was that profound high drama that I liked. This was that phone call where you know someone is dead. Maybe enjoy isn't the right word, but the sense that something important is happening to you, that you're actually in four-down territory and all you can do is hope for an ugly win. The drama that can define a life. And that grotesque knowledge that regardless of the devastation, your ego is still lurking in there somewhere. Being aware of your own flaws or character defects, or even just the simple reality that part of yours or anyone's true inner character could be considered reprehensible, is what affords you empathy for others. You only have to have felt greed or need on enough of a level that you could understand someone who robs a bank. If you've ever had even a brief period of abject despair, you should be able to extrapolate that into understanding a suicide. You only need to have lost your mind a little bit to understand the horror that it must be for someone who's lost it all. And that part of my ego and self-awareness at the worst days of my life reminded me that no, this was actually someone else's worst days. That I was actually doing just fine and living vicariously or on the back of someone else's bad beat. I also indulged in the very real sense of freedom that I felt. Gone was that gnawing tumor in my head of things that I need to do even when I don't know what those things are. There's unreturned emails and phone calls, bills and the dentist and that low tire pressure light that keeps coming on. You forget to do so much that the parts you do remember seem like they must just be the tip of the iceberg, and that things are in far more disrepair than you can contemplate. That's my common state of mind. Drinking that fear away has served as a temporary solution to a permanent problem, short term. But catastrophe on this level makes all of that disappear. Seeing the difference between not giving a fuck and actually realizing that none of it matters. Not giving a fuck is an attitude that requires almost as much commitment as giving a fuck in the first place. But when the death phone rings and tells you the bad news, the oil change and your airline status are put into the same bottom drawer as checking the expiration dates on the condiments. The other side of that coin is now I had to come to grips with actually giving a fuck, without a facade or an angle. Everybody took turns talking into Bingo's ear, like a free pull at a slot machine, each hoping that they'd be the King Arthur who could pull the sword from the stone, to whisper whatever fortuitous incantation that would reach her and bring her back around. As well, everyone was aware and courteous when they could tell someone needed to be alone to do this and made space. The one-on-one time was especially punishing emotionally, because in the desperate attempt to get any sign of cognition, I'd dig out loud into the depths of every important memory we'd shared over the years. I'd repeat our favorite stories we loved to tell, all the places we'd gone and all the fantastic friends we'd made together, all of the obstacles we'd faced and the victories we'd shared, all of the embarrassing moments and hilarious missteps in our lives together. I'd whisper every pet name or silly catchphrase that only two people in ridiculous love would ever be caught saying out loud, all the running jokes, every buzzword or talking point that I used to use to try to divine some lucidity when she was in the depths of a psychotic break, to let her know that she was safe and that she was going to pull through, just like she always had. What was intended to jar any splinter of consciousness in her came out like tearful wedding vows or a wistful eulogy. To articulate all of this aloud only served to reinforce all that we'd been together, and the magnitude of what I now stood to lose. I may have been talking into the void, but I was getting through to myself. Everyone who came out of alone time with Bingo wore the same mask of defeat, like they just purged themselves in a confessional only to find that there was nobody listening on the other side of the curtain. There was a shared sense of frustration that this cumulative emotional energy of love should in itself be curative. At some point, I wondered aloud, do you think she'd wake up if I fucked her? I said it in the tone of a joke because I had to, but on some level it was a serious consideration. And as soon as it came out of my mouth, Lindy said she'd wondered the same thing. Not about her fucking Bingo, but the idea if sexual stimulation might serve any therapeutic function. I mean, if nothing else was working, wouldn't you want to say that you tried everything? If I were feasibly on my deathbed, I'd say certainly go ahead and blow me if there's even a remote chance that it grabs my attention before you pull the plug. It kicked off a lively debate on the legality and the moral ramifications, as well as what you might say if you get caught in the middle of such a life hack remedy. I don't know if we came to any solid conclusions on the subject, but everyone still carried enough hope that it was still a bit early to be sterilizing the vibrator. The truth was that internally, I was most likely the least optimistic. I kept it to myself. As days went by with no signs of recovery, death wasn't even the worst possible outcome. I don't know if anyone else voiced the fear of a chronic vegetative state, but I'm sure as fuck everyone was thinking it. I call Bingo my wife as an easily consumed term that defines our relationship to the casual onlooker, but the truth is that we're not bound on any legal level, meaning that I would have no authority to terminate her care should we come to that place. I knew that's what she would have wanted, in this circumstance anyway. In reality, we'd always hoped ideally that we'd die together in a plane crash. That seemed like the way to go, in first class, wearing polyester leisure suits, cocktails in hand. I've spent many a commercial flight daydreaming of the most disturbing and inappropriate things to yell as the aircraft was plummeting towards the earth. I've written a few, but I'm not telling, just in case. But Bingo and I always said that we'd kill ourselves together if life ever got too ugly. Suicide pact, another thing you should get in writing in case one of you winds up in a coma. I initially told Bingo's mother, Gay Bingaman, the person who had clearly and without challenge taken the reins on this project, that I'd be best suited off-property for the most part. Hospitals give me the creeps on a level that I cannot explain or exaggerate. I posted up at the A-Loft Hotel a block away and did what I could to facilitate travel and lodging for all of those whose plans had been disrupted, which included most everyone. I found the family an Airbnb, also within walking distance, to accommodate them all as a compound, a situation room. If I have any skills from a life on the road, it's booking travel and saying the worst possible thing at any given time. Now I could employ both, while the rest held the bedside vigil. The bar at the A-Loft didn't open until 4 p.m., which I saw as a sign that perhaps I should spend more time sober. Then I saw a sign for another bar just across the way that opened earlier. Then I found a liquor store that could turn my room into a 24-hour bar. And eventually, that bar would move to the hospital. Everyone had their own real worlds that would begin demanding them back, regardless of their desire to stay. The hours that Gay would be putting in as the crew became more skeletal were impossible. It became clear that my cush job playing travel agent was coming to an end, and I was going to have to start pulling shifts at the ICU. Gay seemed to turn a blind eye to the fact that I'd show up drunk and continue to drink out of the bar that I'd secreted into the hospital room closet. I don't think it was a secret to anyone. In fact, I could occasionally even coerce Gay into having a Bailey's on the rocks when the stress became intolerable. The only time I remember her having a real drink, and if I recall accurately, two drinks, was on the sixth night of Bingo's stay. By now, everyone involved had been corralled into a WhatsApp group to keep organized and quickly in touch. And on that evening, phones went ablaze. Gay had been sitting alone with Bingo when Bingo darted forward and upright in bed and through glazed eyes, looked at her and stated simply, I gotta pee. My memory of it is of watching the entire city of Tucson jumping out of their seats in ecstatic cheers, arms raised in victory. In my head, horns were blaring in traffic as people spilled into the streets, swinging each other in their arms. Workplaces were shuttered in celebration, and all the drinks were on the house. Neil Armstrong had landed on the moon. The Cubs won the pennant. The Allied forces had just brought the Axis to its knees, and our boys were coming home, while Jesus had come back and admitted that he'd always been just an elaborate ruse. Everyone's memory of the details here is skewed by the sheer outburst of joy. But shortly after the news spread, Gay and some others met me at the Aloft bar, where there was a drink on the cocktail menu named the Wake-Up Call. Who fucking knows what was in it, but we drank them. Nobody was in any mood to believe in coincidence tonight. Gay and I hugged and cried and laughed and then began hugging strangers in the bar and the lobby. My daughter had to pee, Gay exclaimed to the confused stares of the guests and employees she accosted. We were careful to remind each other that we were far from out of the woods. This wasn't just a case of Gilligan getting hit in the head with a coconut, getting amnesia only to have another coconut later knock him on the noggin and coming right back to normal. But fuck out of the woods, we needed to celebrate. We needed anything positive at that point. So we had another round of wake-up calls and hugged more strangers. It would be some time before Bingo would have to pee again or show much more sign of lucidity. But I soon found myself thrown into positions of responsibility I never saw coming. Up until that point, I had no hand in anything on the medical side of things other than wincing and thinking, ew, that looks gross. Gay handled all that shit. She has a medical background. I have a history of ignoring things and looking the other way. But now there was a question as to whether Bingo should get a trach put in. She'd had a violent intubation just before her birthday helicopter ride. That's where some inept EMT tried to shove the breathing tube down her neck like he was doing gagging porn. Her vocal cords were fucked. These are things I only remember because I heard them repeated near me often enough while I was making cocktails in the closet. Gay called me and told me that there was now an important meeting with one of Bingo's doctors that I should be present for. I couldn't understand why I'd be of benefit in any meeting of importance, including ones regarding my own career. There was some question as to the possibility that if the trach went wrong, she might be forced to have it for a lifetime, and I was there because I was her husband, and I should be the one to make the ultimate decision. I was not prepared for this. The only time I'd come up in conversation with medical staff was on Bingo's initial arrival, when they had to soft grill the parents on whether her injuries might be a matter of domestic violence. I almost felt pride in that they'd consider I had the capacity for it. The doctor explained the options in great detail, while houseflies wandered unencumbered in and out of my hangdog mouth. The doctor left the room like a car salesman, allowing us time to come to a decision or come up with a counteroffer. Mother and father were as conflicted as I was confused. The alternative to a life with a hole in the neck was, I think, something that made her uncomfortable in the short run. Myself, I always side with happiness in the present, meaning that I wouldn't want a hole cut in my neck. I guess I didn't press my case very strongly, because shortly afterwards, they cut that hole in her throat. Chapter 20, The Night Shift. Bingo's bladder-induced return to the living may have been inspiring on that night, but it proved to bring about a new plate of issues. Although she was nowhere near fully realized, she was now aware of the discomfort from the myriad of tubes going in and out of her and was relentless in trying to pull them out. This required that we either have eyes on her 24 hours or we take the draconian step to fasten her wrists to the railings of the bed, which added another level still of heartache. But there's only so many times you can pull her hand back from yanking at her face, only to have it slap immediately back up before you say, fuck it, get the restraints. As the number of available eyes dwindled, we rearranged our schedules yet again. All the important shit dealing with doctors and diagnoses, all of the things I had no business being involved in, happened during the day. Gay and whoever was available for support from Camp Bingaman would cover that. And I and whoever I could rally, mostly Chad Shank, would cover from roughly 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. Chad gave me some semblance of sanity, with equal abilities in trading the absolute worst things to say at any given moment to keep it light. All in whispers, of course. These nights, the best thing you could hope for was Bingo to be asleep as much as possible. When she was awake, you'd talk to her like a houseplant, hoping that any of it would get through. And most of all, don't let her see you cry. If my face at all reflected what I was seeing and feeling, she'd know exactly how fucked she was. Chad and I would take turns hiking the long journey to get completely off hospital property in order to smoke, me cigarettes and him weed. The sneaky bar stayed in play in the closet. We found it curious that the nurse's station never questioned why we kept coming up to refill our ice bucket. The Adderall kept us blinking through the small hours where your head starts to become an infection. The jokes wane and the ramifications wax. You feel like you're afloat inside a bowl where there's no visible horizon. By the morning, Chad and I would trade notes with Gay on the day shift and then walk out through the parking lot and back to the hotel like line workers coming off a shift, silent and disheveled. Chad driving the 2 hours home to take a nap long enough to drive back in order to keep us all alive. As if the universe decided to shit on top of the compost pile, Bingo then developed C. diff. It's some hideous bacterial infection that requires everything short of a hazmat suit and a delousing merely to come in and out of the room with her. This made our regular walks for ice and smokes even more protracted. One common course of action to defeat this is a fecal transplant. So the universe also shares my sense of humor. I pondered the idea of trying to be the donor where, like my lungs or my liver, my feces would be denied for being too unhealthy, that even my shit wasn't worth a shit. As days went by, I'd keep score of Bingo's progress by counting the tubes that were slowly becoming unnecessary and coming out of her, and I'd whisper those numbers into her ear, trying to ignore the fact that she'd still be blindly pulling at the ones that remained. I was getting irritated that wherever her uninhabited mind lay, she couldn't drum up a little positive energy and gratitude. This is why I would never have children. I know that my ability to suffer fools is short at best, and that children are nothing but tiny idiots with a solid excuse. Bingo's recovery was in the toddler stage, where although you can't have a conversation, she could make some basic eye contact communication, and was learning to walk a bit with assistance. With the rectal tube and catheter removed, she could occasionally make it to the toilet, and sometimes she could not. Our relationship had had its issues, but one thing was sure now. When you're trying to corral a slow-rolling tide of liquid diet lava shit, yelling into the night for help because the torrent is threatening to breach the levee of the only towels that were in reach, nobody can tell you that your relationship lacks intimacy. Like most lazy parenting, I soon discovered that I could just plop my rambunctious child in front of a screen to keep it from pulling at the tubes and restraints. She would show flashes of recollection often enough that I thought to bring in my laptop to show her familiar things. By now, Impractical Jokers had 50,000 episodes available online, and she lit up like muted fireworks when I set the screen in front of her. The smile dripped across her face like the disjointed makeup of a retarded clown until she'd fall asleep, and that smile was more than a pile of gold to me. All of our old baggage was gone, and this new crate seemed nothing but a minor obstacle when I saw that single light of recognition. Bingo was also a musician, sometimes alone in a room where you could only hear by standing with your ear to the door, and sometimes she'd come out and play where you could watch. She played an acoustic guitar and was always reading the lyrics off notepads. She could never memorize the words and always seemed to hesitate before finding the chord, but she was intent on hitting the marks. My only understanding of music is that sometimes I can tolerate it, but for the most part, I find it to be an intrusion. And when my wife had been repeating a limited playlist for so many years, I tended to become annoyed. But now, having seen her come somewhat alive, I searched every part of my memory for the names of any of those songs that she played. The Lumineers song, Slow It Down, has a chorus that says, "Slow it down, Angie, come back to bed. Rest your arms and rest your legs." Bingo used to sing this song, and I would brood that the rhyming structure was ridiculously flawed. Angie, come back to bed. Rest your arms and rest your legs? No, idiot. Head. Bed rhymes with head. Bed, head. These are the things that can consume the bitter mind. But now, when Bingo's stretching her empty bucket to find any random memory of something that rings familiar, these songs became anthems to me. There's a picture of us slow dancing to the Lumineers just between her hospital bed and bathroom in a loitering lithium shuffle to this song. It's branded into my head. Like she was almost alive and we were almost in love again, where I could finally see this treasure in her that used to be a trivial irritant. We danced in a tiny lethargic circle while I watched her countenance fight for any ounce of understanding of what was happening. The song brought back a spark, but that spark only added more to her confusion. Yet she'd still stare half blank into my face, and her lips would curl up in an idiot's grin, as though she knew that the connection had not been completely lost. Like she was desperately trying to give some hope back to me. "Don't ask for cigarettes. She ain't got nothing left for you." I can't say if I ever saw Chad Shank cry, but I know I wasn't ashamed to cry in front of him. But Chaley's face would wet the bed in a way that I could never imagine. It was more frightening than even the thought of Chad breaking down, because while Chad is the hammer, Chaley is the rock. He was my flight attendant. Chaley is one of the few in the crew who has no addictions or fractures of mind, nor does he ever show much in the way of emotion. Tracy crying was as simple as watching one of those ASPCA sad puppy commercials. Making her fall apart on purpose had been a funhouse sport. So to watch Chaley be even weaker in the knees was almost funny. The Aloft Hotel had these giant cement orbs like solid beanbag chairs for decoration out front where I would go to smoke. I remember Chaley and I lying backwards over them, both bawling our eyes out, midday drunk, with the difference that my tears were half laughing at the fact that he was crying. Einstein or someone said that we mock what we don't understand. I imagine that he was laughing at his best friend spewing tears when he said that. More dead of emotion is Hennigan, who I will swear showed up only because he knew that no one would believe it. Unlike Chaley, Hennigan isn't hiding his innermost feelings. Hennigan feels nothing. He was recruited by the UK version of the CIA in his university days and was rejected because of his lack of empathy. But anytime we all felt lost and disjointed, we could always find a way to put that discomfort onto someone else to break the tension. We were all talking once late outside of Bingo's room when a doctor who made the early morning rounds came by near 3 a.m. Our faces were already draped with fatigue, and I played into that. With a morbid resignation in my eyes, I asked the doctor if she were here to check on room 221. She said that she was. I paused for a beat that seemed more like concern than comic composure. took her eye and, turning my head to the group around me, told her in a solemn tone that we'd decided to pull the plug. The days when that had even been a topic of conversation had been over for a while, and the doctor turned her head between Bingo's bed and us in the hallway outside and said, "But there is no plug." I told her I was just joking, and without joking herself, she asked me, "Are you the father?" There was no laughter remaining by the time we left in the mornings, even when I had to do it professionally. Although I'd canceled the gigs, somehow I still had promo to do. The physical edition of No Place Like Home was about to be released, and although actual DVDs were on the cusp of being antiques, the once hopeful CISO was proving to be a bust since my premiere 2 months prior. If anyone was going to see this special, it was more likely they were going to see it by purchasing the hard copy. After 12 hours shut in the figurative and literal darkness of Bingo's room, the blinding Arizona sunrise shocked you out of your stupor in an angry fashion, like being woken up with a bucket of ice water. You don't giggle. You just get even more pissed off. The type of radio tour that I was about to do works where you sit on the phone with some PR person from the label conferenced in, transferring you every 10 minutes from one morning radio show to the next, across the country from Greenville to Green Bay, from Mark and Mike to Chico and Slophead, all with the most banal drivel of a media platform that's as faded as the phonograph. This is difficult to take seriously, even if you're in a good mood. This morning, they were an outlet for nothing but a face for me to punch. Chaley set me up in the car in the parking lot of the hotel. I couldn't do it in the room because people who were working swing shifts for Bingo were still sleeping, and I needed to yell and smoke. Chaley, I remember, also came back out to repark the car so the sun wouldn't hit me in the face as it rose. Always watching out, that guy. I drank Bushmills from the bottle as I railed harder and uglier at every mindless morning drive-time duo that I was patched through to. I told him about my current dilemma and then railed about the injustice of life and the ridiculousness of being contractually obligated to do press for something as silly as a comedy DVD while my wife is half dead. And the longer the tour went on, the more hostile I became. I began attacking stations for being so fucking trite and vapid with their own cornball fake smiles, like Pied Pipers leading morning commuters off the cliff of their own quotidian existences. I was very unprofessional, and it felt really good. I was hung up on more than once, but I fulfilled my contractual obligation for doing press, and I'm sure that I burned many bridges that I never wanted to cross again anyway. Thank you, Shreveport. Sad Sack has left the building. Chapter 21, The Ron Rule. When Bingo and I had broken up at the beginning of the year, I wanted to do stand-up because breakups are great fodder for new material and alleviating, if nothing else. But now I felt like I needed to do stand-up because I wanted to inflict this pain onto the masses, and like the radio stations,